KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
This day may very well turn out to be the day that House Republicans lost control of the United States House of Representatives.
The major tax bill that cleared the House this week, what it means for policy and what it means for politics. For Saturday, May 24th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, we will examine how conspiracy theories are making their way from corners of social media into the Oval Office.
It's important to say sometimes these narratives are based on grains of truth, or they're based on nothing more than claiming that immigrants are eating household pets.
We will hear about a new award-winning book in India and check in on the state of sumo wrestling in Japan. And on Memorial Day weekend, we will hear about electric grills.
Just hit the button and get the power. And then you can choose what temperature you want it on. So we can start 500 and then just click it.
All that and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The Defense Department is implementing new restrictions on journalists covering the Pentagon. As NPR's Kristen Wright reports, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced the changes in a memo, saying it's a matter of national security.
The restrictions ban reporters and other media from many areas of the Pentagon unless they're accompanied by an approved government escort. The newly restricted areas include the offices of Hegseth, his top aides, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and other key locations of the complex historically open to credentialed press during previous administrations. The Pentagon Press Association says it's a direct attack on the freedom of the press and America's right to know what its military is doing. The National Press Club is urging the Pentagon to reverse course. Hegseth says additional security measures are coming. It's the latest step by the White House to limit access for journalists and prevent potential leaks. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
A federal judge has blocked for now the Trump administration's attempts to revoke Harvard's ability to enroll foreign students. From member station GBH, Kirk Carapeza reports this has an effect beyond Cambridge.
The Department of Homeland Security said Harvard couldn't enroll foreign students because it didn't provide disciplinary records from campus protests. Harvard called the move unlawful and retaliatory, and a judge agreed, issuing a temporary restraining order letting the university sponsor 7,000 international students, most of whom pay full tuition. Geraldo Blanco directs the Center for International Higher Education at Boston College.
The top universities in the United States, now they all are under this cloud of uncertainty that their ability to enroll international students could be revoked just by a signature.
Blanco says these attacks on Harvard and other selective schools could have lasting effects on U.S. higher ed. For NPR News, I'm Kirk Carapeza in Boston.
Candlelight, crosses, and tears filled Uvalde, Texas today as the community marked 3 years since the Robb Elementary School shooting that left students and teachers dead. From Texas Public Radio, Sally Aranda has more.
On May 24, 2022, a gunman stormed Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, killing 19 students and two teachers. Law enforcement waited more than an hour to confront the gunman.
There's people every day missing milestones.
Sofia Samaripa is one of the many residents who attended a vigil for the families of the victims and the survivors.
I'm sorry that it ever had to happen this way, and that hate's always going to divide us, that our light has to continue to shine.
Two former officers face child endangerment charges as victims' families continue to push for accountability. I'm Celia Aranda in Uvalde.
And you're listening to NPR News. From Washington. Dissident Iranian filmmaker Jafar Panahi's thriller, It Was Just an Accident, won the Palme d'Or at the 78th Cannes Film Festival. He received a standing ovation after the jury announced his movie won for the strong critique of oppression in his home country. Panahi was repeatedly arrested and imprisoned in Iran for speaking out against the regime. Meanwhile, southeastern France was hit by a major power outage today as the film festival was preparing to hand out its top prizes. The festival switched to an independent power supply, and the show went on. Movie theaters will be setting records this weekend with a 1-2 punch that's becoming a Hollywood habit. NPR's Bob Mondello has more.
2 years ago, Barbenheimer showed that two films...
Hi, Barbie!
Hi, Ken!
...if they had different audiences...
This is the most important thing to ever happen.
...could succeed on the same weekend. Last year, it was Glicked with Gladiator targeting guys...
This is about survival!
...Wicked going for women and girls...
Popular.
This weekend, it's Lilo and Stitch...
I'm gonna give you to the count of three, Stitch.
...and Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning.
Smart people on every side are close to panicking.
As with the others, the feminine side of the equation will make more money, but both films will do well. Not sure what to call the phenomenon, Stitch and Impossalilo, maybe? But together, by Monday, the two films are expected to take in close to $250 million at American box offices. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. House Republicans muscled through President Trump's massive tax and spending bill this week. The early morning vote came together in part because of a final personal push from Trump himself. The legislation still has a long road to go before it can become law, but the vote this week sends a clear message about where the Republican Party is today. So what does this all mean for Trump and the Republicans' agenda, and what does it tell us about how they're governing? We'll talk it through with NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh. Hey, Deirdre.
Hey, Scott.
Remind us again, what is in this package?
So this bill includes $3.8 trillion in tax cuts, $1.5 trillion in spending cuts, and roughly $300 billion for defense and border security programs. In terms of the cut, the bulk of those come from changes to the Medicaid program. That's the health care program for low-income, elderly, and disabled people. Adults without dependents need to meet new work requirements, and others will have to meet new eligibility roles. An early estimate from the Congressional Budget Office estimates that because of these changes, at least 3.6 million people could lose their health care coverage. The bill also includes cuts to food assistance programs and a $4 trillion increase to the country's borrowing authority. That's to avoid a default on the nation's debt later this summer.
Deirdre, for months we have been talking about the huge divisions in the House Republican caucus, the fact that they have such a narrow majority, and that really endangered this bill, and yet it passed.
Scott, it really came down to one factor, and that's President Donald Trump. As we've seen in previous high-stakes votes in the House of Representatives, where there is a very narrow margin, three votes right now, the president is the closer. You know, I talked to one House chairman who told me he expected Speaker Johnson to get the bill 90% of the way, 90 yards down the field, but then he said Trump was going to have to barrel through the final 10 to get it over the finish line, and that's really how it played out. We saw Trump come to the Hill on Tuesday. Even though there were these divisions between moderates and conservatives, he didn't really get into the details, but he made it clear they needed to get in line. When things started to blow up the next day, folks went to the White House, and they did get in the line. In the end, only two Republicans voted no, one voted present.
Were there any major changes to the bill as all of this played out?
No, I mean, really minor changes, but it really came down to a political calculation for House Republicans. They do not want to get sideways with Trump or the Republican base. They could risk a primary challenge, a mean tweet threatening to take them out in their next campaign.
Let's go from mean tweets to policy. the substance of this bill, what does it say about where the Republican Party is today?
I mean, it is clear that it is Trump's party. He campaigned on renewing his 2017 tax cuts that will expire at the end of this year. Back then in 2017, he was working with people like House Speaker Paul Ryan, who was pushing really hard to have major changes, structural changes, to mandatory spending programs like Medicaid, Medicare. Trump took those kinds of things off the table this time around. He really focused on sort of smaller items that he targeted to a political constituency. He campaigned on removing taxes on tips and overtime to get at working class voters in places like Las Vegas. And that really helped his party get a lot of new supporters this time around. Those items are in the bill, no tax and overtime, but they expire at the end of Trump's term. The rest of the spending cuts are permanent. And I will just say, as a whole, the Republican Party over years has been focused on reducing the deficit. Not so much in the House Republican package. We do talk a lot about these spending cuts, but in the grand scheme, this bill adds trillions to the debt.
Trillions. So this heads to the Senate. What do we expect there?
There are going to be changes. And it's possible at the end of the day, the sort of one thing that brings the Republican Party together, extending these tax cuts, could be sort of the one thing that ends up sort of being the easier thing to get done, along with money for the border. Medicaid cuts could be a problem for some Senate Republicans, and there are other conservatives in the Senate who just dismiss the House bill as really not serious on slashing spending. Senate Majority Leader John Thune talked this week about this whole fact that the U.S. credit rating was downgraded due to ballooning deficits.
A lot of our colleagues have made it very clear that in order for a bill to get through the House and the Senate and on the president's desk, it has to make a meaningful dent in the out-of-control spending we've seen over the past several years.
But again, Scott, I think it's going to end up coming down to President Trump, again, bridging these divides.
This is certainly going to be one of the biggest things, if not the biggest thing that Congress does this term. That means it's going to be a big issue in the midterms. Curious how the Democrats are responding to all of this.
I mean, even before the House vote happened, we saw protests in districts across the country targeting swing House Republicans focused on the impact of Medicaid cuts. There are a lot of districts where Republicans say their constituents rely on Medicaid. One House Republican, Dan Newhouse from Washington State, told me that 40% of his constituents are currently enrolled in Medicaid. And it's pretty clear Democrats are making this the central 2026 issue. Here's just some of what House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said right before the vote.
This day may very well turn out to be the day that House Republicans lost control of the United States House of Representatives.
Democrats are really hoping that this is a rerun of the 2018 midterms. Mm-hmm. Back in 2017, Republicans focused on repealing and replacing Obamacare. There was a lot of backlash. They hope that happens again.
That is NPR's Deirdre Walsh. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Scott.
This week, a woman who was relatively unknown in her own country was awarded one of the most prestigious prizes in all of literature, the International Booker Prize. It's awarded to books translated into English. The book is called Heartland. The author is from India, which is where correspondent Dia Hadid lives. She is on the line to tell us more about it. And a warning, this conversation does include a discussion about suicide. Hi, Dia.
Hi, Scott.
So tell us a bit about the book and about the author.
Yeah, Banu Mushtaq is in her 70s, and she's been writing stories for decades in her mother tongue, Kannada. It's spoken by tens of millions of people in southwest India. But in a country of 1.4 billion people, Kannada is a regional language, so Mushtaq wasn't well known outside of her own literary circles. That is until translator Deepa Bhakti offered to work with her, and they picked out a selection of stories she'd written over three decades. And that collection, called Heartland, created a buzz. The stories simply sketch out moments of the lives of Kannada-speaking Muslim women. And these are lives defined by casual misogyny and sly resistance. The language is very simple, but textured. It's written in the rhythm and slang of Kannada dialect. And you get a sense of that as Mushtaq spoke after she won the Booker International.
This moment feels like a thousand fireflies lighting up a single sky. Brief, brilliant, and utterly collective.
A thousand fireflies lighting up a single sky.
That's such an evocative image. I love it. How was the book received in India?
With a lot of joy in literary circles. There's something about Mushtaq's unlikely and late success that's been celebrated, but also because of how vividly these stories are written. Like, Kanika Sharma is a writer and journalist, and she interviewed the author and translator before they won. And she says the book stays with her.
It really feels as if I'm watching theater, and these characters are in front of me, and I'm observing their lives. It just doesn't feel as if it's a story written for the page.
Tia, I can tell from the way you're telling me about this that you have read and appreciated this book yourself. Are there any stories that stand out to you in the collection?
A few, but I think the one that couldn't leave me and many others is called Heartlamp. And it's about a woman whose husband takes up with a nurse after decades of marriage and children. And her family rejects the idea of her leaving him, says she'll ruin their reputation, and they tell her it's better if she ends her own life. And that evening, she douses herself with kerosene. Her eldest daughter rushes towards her. Now, Ambika Mott is a British actress. She reads out the last part of the scene as part of a presentation for the book for the award.
She held her mother's legs. Salma was sobbing and the little baby was crying on the ground. Merrin looked at them and she fought to be free of that strange force that had enveloped her. And then the matchbox fell from her hand.
I mean, some of the subject matter does sound very intense.
Yeah, some of the stories are, frankly. Some of the other stories, though, are really sly and funny and undercut these petty men who lord over women.
Is it fair to say that a lot of this touches on sensitive ground, though? You know, these themes of Muslim women being mistreated at the hands of Muslim men. I'm gathering that probably many people would object to that type of characterization.
Yeah. Banu Mushtaq has said some folks think she won a prize by denigrating Muslim men. But these stories come from her own experiences and of women she met as an advocate. And the thing is, Muslims form one in every six Indians. That's more than 240 million people. Their experiences are incredibly diverse. One book cannot speak for all of them. And I did ask another prominent writer, Sabah Naqvi, what she thought about all this. She happens to be Muslim. She says the strengths of these stories are in how grounded they are.
There are many, many books which have come out about being Muslim, but this one tells it in another way, because people don't often live their lives with the politics inside their head. They just live their lives in their neighborhoods, within their families. So that's what's remarkable.
And another literary critic, Shamana Mukherjee, notes, like, so often in India, where the Hindu nationalist government in power has used divisive language to describe Muslims, what's rare about this book is that it's by a Muslim woman speaking plainly and hoping to create empathy.
That is NPR's Dia Hadid in Mumbai. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Scott.
And if you or someone you know is in crisis, please call, text, or chat with the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. This week, Congress voted to roll back a part of the Clean Air Act that controls toxic air pollutants, altering decades of how those toxins were regulated.
It includes oil refineries, chemical plants, coke ovens, aluminum plants, lead smelters, you know, things of that nature. We call it the worst of the worst list.
A closer look at what this rollback means and the political back and forth that led to it tomorrow on All Things Considered. You can listen on the radio, online, or by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Trump spoke at West Point's graduation ceremony today, telling grads they're part of a new golden age in the country, and vowed the military would no longer be involved in nation-building crusades as he celebrated his efforts to get rid of diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. It's the first military commencement address of his second term. The Trump administration has temporarily lifted several major sanctions on Syria, making good on a promise the president made earlier this month to help the country's new leader establish a stable country after overthrowing the Assad dictatorship last year. And Ukraine and Russia exchanged prisoners of war for a second day, with each side welcoming nearly 700 people home since yesterday. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From the University at Buffalo, the University at Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. If you are planning to grill this Memorial Day weekend, that probably involves burning fossil fuel. But that's changing as manufacturers develop electric grills. They're climate-friendly, and some customers find them more convenient than gas or charcoal. NPR's Jeff Brady reports from a backyard in Philadelphia.
It's just before dinner, and Stoyo Kachev is wheeling his grill across a patio to an electrical outlet. Kachev and his family replaced a propane grill with this electric one. It looks like a traditional freestanding gas grill, dark gray, and with a digital display on the front.
Just hit the button, and you get the power, and then you can choose what temperature you want it on. So we could start 500, and then you just click it.
On the menu tonight, two family favorites.
We are making some Bulgarian short rib, and we're going to make some Vietnamese pork belly.
Don Nim says grilling with electric is convenient.
We used to have a gas grill, and we used to go buy propane, and not only is it getting more expensive, but it's just a pain to lug around. So I was sold when I learned that we could just plug it in and grill whenever we wanted to and not have to buy anything extra.
Switching from a fossil fuel to electricity generated by an increasingly cleaner grid also reduces their contribution to climate change. Whether running an electric or propane grill is cheaper depends on utility rates and local propane prices. Though if you don't have an outdoor outlet, that might involve hiring an electrician. Young couples like Nim and Kachev are a target for the company that makes this grill. Tom Pinner is CEO of Current Backyard and says demand for electric grills is growing.
You have a lot of empty nesters that also find it more convenient to simply plug into their outlet, right? And 15 minutes later, have a grill that's hot enough to cook on.
Current's parent company also makes Charbroil brand grills. Pinner says some customers have doubts about a grill with no flame.
People are skeptical because of those previous experiences where they've used small grills or, you know, years ago, there are even indoor grills that didn't get very hot that were electric.
This grill heats up to 700 degrees, and Penner says electric is good for cooking vegetables, too. You can control the temperature more precisely. To get a professional's opinion, we visited Zachary's BBQ and Soul in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, where one of the cooks was shucking corn.
I think that electric grills are ridiculously convenient.
Keith Taylor is the chef and owner of this catering business. For quickly grilling hamburgers and hot dogs, he says electric grills are fine.
I think that there's a place for them, especially if you're not a purist like me who must have wood or must have charcoal or want those kind of flavors imparted in food.
Still, Taylor says there are ways to add flavor on an electric grill. Some models have lava rocks or fake briquettes as juices start to come out of the meat.
When those droplets of food hit those rocks, they vaporize and you start getting the smell and sometimes the spark. Then every once in a while, a little bit of flame out of an electric grill.
Taylor says electric grills are better at making those perfect grill marks. He says the electric grill surface temperature recovers faster than gas or charcoal after you place cold food on it.
Ooh, yeah. Look at those grill marks.
Yeah.
Don Nim's Vietnamese pork belly is still cooking, but Kachev's short ribs are ready.
Tastes Bulgarian. Meaty.
Nice.
Very good.
Maybe not up to a barbecue chef's high standards, but for this couple, an electric grill is perfect for an evening meal in the backyard. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Philadelphia.
It is the apex of sumo wrestling in Japan.
Fast start. Haku Oho has the Yokozuna in trouble, but he bends a knee.
The Tokyo Grand Sumo Tournament comes to an end this weekend. Just ahead of the rise of a new Yokozuna or Grand Champion, we reached out to NHK sumo announcer Ross Mahara.
Well, I think it's way more than two big fat guys running into each other.
Mahara is a veteran sumo wrestling play-by-play announcer for the Japanese public broadcaster. He has been one of the voices calling this two-week tournament when rankings aren't based on size, but on wins.
That's kind of the charm of the sport. Yeah, there are no weight classes. So, of course, fans love it when a small guy goes up against a guy who's twice his size and twice his weight.
Beyond the collision of beefy men in a small dirt ring, it's the technique, finesse, and stamina that win matches.
So as far as who wins a match and who loses a match, there's nothing lost in translation, and it's very easy to understand, right? There's a ring, you know, if you touch with any body part other than the soles of your feet, you lose. So if you, you know, put a hand down or you lose your balance or whatever, or if you step out of the ring, then you also lose.
The top sumo superstars find themselves in the ring 15 times in 15 days.
It is a combat sport, but sumo is not just a sport. It's a lifestyle for these athletes. So it's a really harsh way to make a living. But for these guys, they're all very dedicated.
And the fans packing the Tokyo Dojo enjoy the continuous battles, but they're all there to see one wrestler rise to the top. Ono Sato.
Ono Sato trying to fend off Ono Sato. Ono Sato has it inside position. Morozashi, this looks good for Waka Takakage. But the goodbye goes to Ono Sato.
This guy, Ono Sato, is called the Shohei Ohtani of sumo now, yeah, since he's so much better than everyone else.
Now, with only one match left, it is up to the giant men in the small ring to crown a sumo champ. At the White House this past week, a meeting between President Trump and South African President Cyril Ramaphosa began cordially, but took a turn.
Turn the lights down, and just put this on. It's right behind you.
President Trump started to play a video which showed a row of hundreds of white crosses alongside a country road.
These are burial sites right here. Burial sites. Over 1,000. White farmers.
Trump told the South African president that each cross was the burial site of a murdered white farmer in his country. This was not true. The footage was from a demonstration following the deaths of two people killed on their farm. Their killers were convicted and sentenced. But the truth has not stopped President Trump from trying to bolster the false claim that there was a genocide happening against white farmers in South Africa.
But you do allow them to take land.
No.
They do allow them to take land.
No, nobody can
take
land.
And then when they take the land, they kill the white farmer. And when they kill the white farmer, nothing happens to them.
No, there is quite
nothing happens.
This false narrative came from a fringe group of right-wing Afrikaners. In 2018, one of them appeared on the Tucker Carlson show on Fox News.
I thought the whole point of the new South Africa and the reason the rest of us were excited to see it in 1994 take shape is because it rejected racial discrimination. And yet the government is now embracing it, or am I missing something?
No. In a free and civilized society, we don't take people's stuff.
Again, there's no proof of a white genocide in South Africa. NPR's Michelle Martin recently spoke with South African journalist Reedy Klabi.
There is no unique crime directed at white people that has a race lens. South Africa has an unacceptably high crime rate. The majority of victims of murder in South Africa are black men.
Nor has the country seized the land of white South Africans. Here's journalist Kate Bartlett reporting for NPR.
More than 30 years after the end of apartheid, white South Africans, who account for over 7% of the population here, still own the vast majority of commercial farmland. South Africa passed a controversial law in January allowing the potential expropriation of land without compensation in some circumstances. But contrary to Trump's allegations, zero land has been seized.
And yet the Trump administration granted refugee status to 59 Afrikaners last week, with more expected in the future. This is not the first time that a falsehood that began on the fringes of the right wing made its way into the Trump White House. NPR's Lisa Hagan covers how once fringe beliefs go mainstream. She's with me now to talk about how that happens. Welcome.
Hi, Scott.
So let's start with the claims that there is a genocide of white South Africans, which didn't come out of nowhere.
No, what we're seeing is the result of an activist effort that's been underway since Trump's first term. In South Africa itself, the arguments you heard from Trump come from a small, fairly fringe group of right-wing Afrikaners. In 2018, one of these lobbyists was featured on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News at the time. And hours later, Trump tweeted instructions to his Secretary of State to look into supposed anti-white discrimination and murder there. So the president has also obviously had a closer relationship with Elon Musk in recent years, who's from South Africa. And Musk has been promoting many of these same narratives we heard in the Oval Office this week. And he's also complained for years about requirements in South Africa that companies like Musk's Starlink give 30% equity to historically disadvantaged groups.
And there's a broader context here to this phrase of white genocide, right?
Right. Quote unquote, white genocide has been a mainstay of white power groups since the 1980s. And obviously, themes of Black people posing a danger to whites are much, much older than that. There's also a related strain of nostalgia and support for bygone apartheid regimes, for example, in Zimbabwe, that's become very popular among hard right white supremacists.
And this is a general pattern that we have seen over and over again, where if you are somebody who consumes news from mainstream and legacy news outlets, you are just totally bewildered by what the president and his allies are talking about. Where do many of these claims and narratives come from?
Yeah, it shouldn't really be a surprise at this point. Donald Trump has benefited for years from an extremely devoted ecosystem of media figures that range from, you know, comparatively more mainstream outlets like Fox News down through conspiracy theorists like Alex Jones and social media influencers. It's an ecosystem that produces and elevates some of its own favorite narratives and jumps into action to support false claims from Trump and his supporters. And you see motivated actors like, say, pro-Russia propagandists or promoters of racist pseudoscience being welcomed into that media bloodstream all the time. The narratives that surface are the ones that are most useful to the people who make policy or influence it. Earlier this month, for instance, when Tucker Carlson again platformed a South African white genocide activist, he framed it as, quote, what happens when you take DEI seriously. It's important to say sometimes these narratives are based on grains of truth, like cherry picking a fraction of murders in South Africa, or they're based on nothing more than some guy in an internet comment section claiming that immigrants are eating household pets.
Which, of course, took over the presidential campaign for several weeks last year. How does this kind of information environment change the way that governing is done, though?
You're seeing it every day. Trump's beliefs about South Africa are dictating refugee policy. Partisan narratives about diversity initiatives have become executive orders. Anti-transgender activism has led to banning books in school libraries, now possibly eliminating gender-affirming care from the national budget. Government officials also spend resources trying to prove theories in special counsel investigations or congressional hearings.
What about those moments, though, which do happen, where something that is initially framed by a lot of the mainstream media as a conspiracy theory does end up being somewhat valid?
A lot of what we're talking about has fueled the breakdown of societal trust, where people get comfortable dismissing claims that end up having some actual merit, like Hunter Biden's laptop actually ended up in a Delaware computer shop. And Joe Biden may have been declining earlier than many people wanted to believe. And those rare moments then reinforce the entire cycle of conspiracist storytelling that insists you can't take anything accepted by the mainstream at face value.
Are there any specific examples of when these conspiracy theories, you know, boomerang back on Trump and the others who promote them from government purchase?
You know, there are fewer significant examples of that than you might think. There can definitely be uncomfortable moments where you get some social media grumbling about a government official contradicting a false narrative they've promoted in the past. Like very recently, FBI officials Kash Patel and Dan Bongino, you know, told a Fox News interviewer that Jeffrey Epstein did in fact kill himself. They've looked at the documents. And there was a moment of sort of shock about that. But just like that example, more often than not, those moments either fade pretty quickly or you see the conspiracy media ecosystem instantly spawn more narratives that help believers ignore that contradiction. They just had to say that publicly, but they're still on our side secretly.
That is NPR's Lisa Hagen. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Musicians, poets, and artists have shown up day after day to bring a livelier energy to an intersection in Minneapolis marked by tragedy. It's the place where George Floyd was murdered 5 years ago this weekend. NPR's Meg Anderson spoke to people in the community about how they have been using the arts to heal.
The street corner where George Floyd died is still partly blocked today, covered in murals and mementos people have left. For some, it's a place that must be preserved. For others, it feels trapped in its darkest day. But the people who live and work here are finding ways forward, using art and music and writing.
We're doing a class tonight, man, if you're interested.
Marquise Bowie is one of those people. He got out of prison in 2019. Now he leads a creative writing class at the Square.
And this is a way that I can actually honor my mom. My mom died about 8 months before I was coming home from prison, and she never got to see me at my potential.
Vanessa Harrison says the classes, for her, are cathartic. At a recent one, she wrote a poem about memorials like the one here.
I have it right here. Okay.
She pulls a notebook out and reads some of it.
The tattered roses with faded pink ribbons, the teddies whose softness has been compromised by constant exposure to unforgiving elements, communicating silently the message that trauma lives in this place.
What she feels most here, she says, is heartbreak.
This place is known all over the entire earth as a place where George Floyd was killed. And yes, it sparked many movements, but now that's our story.
She doesn't want that to be the only story told. Up the street at the Plot Art Gallery, Ace Rice, the owner, is also trying to tell other stories about the history of this place. He gestures to a painting. It shows a row of black men swinging hammers along a train track.
So the exhibit we have up now is called Gandhi Dancer. It's essentially a deep dive into the history of the laborers of the railroad here in Minnesota.
Rice's great-grandfather was one of those laborers.
Without the Gandhi dancers, no trains would run.
Those workers, often immigrants and black men, did hard labor realigning train tracks in unison. In a way, that's what Rice is hoping to do here. He wants to uplift this street corner.
It's our attempt to continue to just do our part to push the narrative, the conversation, and our history from an artistic lens forward.
A few doors down, at a gas station that's been vacant since Floyd's death, a group of musicians is warming up. Every Monday night for the last 5 years, they've met here to play.
Rain, shine, sleet, snow. We've been here in cold temperatures where horns won't work, but we show up anyways because it's bigger than ourselves.
Butchie Austin is one of the group's leaders. He says the music sends a message. They're still here, and they still want change. But also,
it's hard to show up in the space, hear 40 people playing their instruments with all of their breath and all their lungs, and not smile and not dance.
The sun is dipping low in the sky as the group starts playing. But the light is reflecting off their instruments, making it a little brighter here than it would be otherwise. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
After George Floyd's murder 5 years ago, black families yet again had to warn their sons about the very real danger of racism.
My fear
was solidified.
Am I going to be having this conversation 30 years from now? When is it going to stop?
A father and son talk about the talk. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. A federal judge in Boston is ordering the Trump administration to facilitate the return of a Guatemalan man who was deported to Mexico. The judge says the man, who said he feared for his safety because he's gay, wasn't given due process. The Justice Department has acknowledged error in the man's case. The Supreme Court is temporarily blocking a watchdog group from accessing records from Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, arguing DOGE is exceeding its legal authority, asking that internal communications, financial disclosures, and other documents be released to the public. And this Memorial Day weekend, AAA says around 45 million people will travel at least 50 miles from home this year. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Over the first 2 weeks of the Sean Combs trial, jurors have heard from more than a dozen witnesses. Prosecutors have called musicians, employees, and investigators in an effort to support their case. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento says the picture they're painting is one of a powerful man running a criminal enterprise that enabled and concealed sex crimes for two decades. And a warning, this report contains mention of violence and sexual assault.
Some big names have taken the witness stand since Sean Combs' trial started. That includes musicians Kid Cudi and Don Richard. Jurors have also heard from hotel employees, law enforcement agents, and male escorts. But for the first 2 weeks, the singer Cassie Ventura has been at the center of the prosecution's story. Ventura testified that throughout the decade she dated Combs, he was physically abusive and controlling. Most infamously, that allegedly meant forcing her to participate in highly orchestrated sexual encounters with male escorts. Aya Gruber is a professor of criminal law at the University of Southern California.
They're bringing in a lot of evidence that this was a relationship that was marked with significant violence, and the defense isn't trying to dispute it.
Combs' defense attorneys admit their client was violent, but suggest Ventura consented to, quote, unconventional sex. During cross-examination, a defense attorney asked Ventura to read through many text messages in which she expressed love for Combs and a willingness to participate. But the prosecution has called 8 witnesses who have supported Ventura's version of events. They include Ventura's mom and former best friend, plus Kid Cudi and Don Richard. Gruber says the aim of all this testimony is to help the prosecution say
she was in a constant state of fearing him, and therefore she did what he said.
The prosecution is depicting Combs as a person who was in control of almost everything. 2 escorts have given extremely graphic testimony about sexual encounters they say they were paid to participate in with Ventura. Combs allegedly watched and gave instructions. Aya Gruber says that's not a strategy many prosecutors would take.
Typically, what you'll have in these cases is the prosecution objecting to anything that's said about sort of the sexual behavior and past sexual acts of the complaining witness, of the alleged victim.
But in this case, Gruber says the government may want jurors to hear those details to suggest Ventura must have been coerced. The defense has argued that these encounters happened in the privacy of Combs' bedroom, and the government has no business prosecuting his preferences. However, two more of the prosecution's witnesses were Combs' former assistants. Both testified that as part of their jobs, they prepared hotel rooms with candles, lubricant, and changes of clothes, and they later cleaned the rooms up. Anthony Capozzolo is a private defense attorney and former federal prosecutor. He says this testimony is key to the government's racketeering charge.
There's not a lot of people who have a personal assistant who a good portion of the 80 to 100 hours that they were working that week was setting up events where women may have been abused or physically assaulted.
Capozzolo says if Combs can be shown to have directed his employees to help him execute and cover up crimes, that could help the prosecutors to prove that their actions were part of an organized effort to conceal abuse or intimidate witnesses or victims into being silent. Prosecutors and Combs' defense both declined to comment. But in court, Combs' defense attorneys continue to suggest that all of these people acted willingly out of respect or love for Combs. Capozzolo says,
they have to show sides of him that the jurors can either respect or be impressed by.
That includes showing how successful Combs has been in his career. Both the prosecution and defense will dispute the ways he chose to exert his power and influence. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
Whether you came of age in the 80s,
I feel the need for speed,
the 90s,
show me the money,
or the 2000s,
the universe is talking to us right now. You just gotta listen.
Tom Cruise has been one of the world's biggest movie stars. His films have grossed over $12 billion worldwide, and at 62, he is still doing it with the release of the 8th Mission Impossible film, Final Reckoning.
I need you to trust me one last time.
To talk more about a career that has gone through more wild turns than your typical Hollywood blockbuster, I have brought in two people who have a lot of thoughts, and I know this firsthand, a lot of thoughts about Tom Cruise. NPR All Things Considered producer Mark Rivers and NPR editor Barry Hardiman. Hey there.
Hi.
Great to be here for this important conversation.
Mark, you have been waiting for this moment to be asked this in a microphone for like perhaps a decade.
Maybe my whole life, honestly.
Here you are. I know you love Tom Cruise. Please tell us why.
For me, he's kind of the ultimate movie star. He's alone among stars I think would actually die for entertainment, die for the movies. Now, I don't condone that, but I do respect it. This guy has built up over the course of a career a passionate, some might say even maniacal devotion to the movies. And I just, it's so hypnotic. It's so fascinating to me. I think with even great movie stars, you can tell when they're checked out of a movie. You know, when the movie's not good, they will check out. And Tom Cruise is never checked out. He is always, he's always dialed in. And if you go back to his career, it is wild just how many straight up bangers that he has in a variety of genres, whether it's the courtroom drama, action movie, thriller, art house, just take like whichever. He just has
so many
rewatchable films in a variety of genres. And I think about this line from Sunset Boulevard, where Gloria Swanson says,
I just fell in love with you all over again.
Where, you know, there's that great line where she says, I'm still big, and it's the pictures that got small.
Yes.
Tom Cruise is not only still big, he wants to keep the movies big. He is I imagine he thinks of himself like Atlas holding up the earth, but the earth is the movies. And it's crazy, but I just love it. And yeah, I'll just watch him in anything until he actually does die for the movies. I will keep watching.
Barry, you and I are older souls than young Mark, and we have seen
thank you for putting
Tom
me
Cruise
in your
rise
category.
We have seen Tom Cruise rise and fall, mm-hmm. and do
jump.
Uncomfortable interviews and jump and ride a motorcycle. True. And twist and turn. Mm-hmm. Where do you come out? Are you pro Tom Cruise? Are you anti Tom Cruise? Are you somewhere in between Tom Cruise? Where are you?
Tom Cruise has been a part of every part of my life. This man has been in movies for 4 decades. I've been watching them for at least that long. I am a huge Tom Cruise fan, and I will agree with you, Mark, that there is something really special about what he does on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was watching Minority Report with the kids the other night, and he walked onto the screen, and I just kind of felt my body relax, like, okay, now I'm at a movie. Yeah. You know, like, okay, great, we're here.
Why'd you catch that?
Because it was gonna fall.
You're certain?
Yeah, but it didn't fall. You caught it. The fact that you prevented it from happening doesn't change the fact that it was going to happen.
And when I try to compare him to other movie stars, you know, I feel like I think of George Clooney as a Cary Grant. Like, I actually don't have a, there's not really a comp
for
him. No
one quite like him. Yeah.
And I, again, I think there are times where the fact that he is Tom Cruise in every movie doesn't serve the movie, but there are plenty of movies where it does. And I think we've all been surprised, you know, by how good he can be in some things. And, but again, as you pointed out, it's an enormous range of movies that can take a Tom Cruise.
If you look at the arc of his career, starting from the 80s and on, you see a lot of interesting choices. Mm-hmm. I remember reading about him making this movie, Losing It, which, you know, if you haven't seen Losing It, that's like American Pie if they went to Tijuana.
We're gonna be as crude as we want, as filthy as we want, and as gross as we want.
It's a terrible movie.
Are you kidding? You just sold it to me.
No, it's a lot worse than the preface sounds. Cruise did not do any press for it, didn't go to the premiere. This quote from him when he's talking about the movie: "I realize not everybody is capable of making a good movie." And he decided after that he only wanted to work with the best people. And he really has. Like, Cruise has worked with Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese, Oliver Stone, Tony and Ridley Scott, Paul Thomas Anderson, Sidney Pollack. It's just, and he's challenged his persona, and he's allowed these directors to kind of play with that persona in a way that I don't see a lot from his peers, like a Clooney or a Brad Pitt. So, I mean, you don't make a movie like Eyes Wide Shut, you know, a movie that you make with your then wife, Nicole Kidman.
I'll tell you what I do know is you got a little stoned tonight. You've been trying to pick a fight with me, and now you're trying to make me jealous.
But you're not the jealous type, are you?
No, I'm not.
You don't make that movie unless you are willing to really test yourself and challenge yourself as a performer.
And challenge the marriage. Yes, exactly. I would agree.
I mean, like, I think that is a good point, though, to talk about, like, Mark, like you said, he's very carefully making choices and building this career, and it's forward motion. Now I'm going to do this. And yet he is also, at the same time, off the screen, his own worst enemy, and kind of derails his career in the short term a few different times by doing interviews in places that are usually kind of like safe places, like Oprah Winfrey's couch, the Today Show set. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember watching these interviews live the first time and just going, oh no, something has gone horribly wrong.
Yeah.
Like, jumping up and down on the couch.
Something happened to you.
I'm in love.
I remember seeing those live. I actually taped Oprah Winfrey every day.
Oh, wow.
But I think he was always going to get his audience back, because in the end, I think there's a sort of subconscious thing where we're like, the guy jumping on the couch is also the guy that's like standing in the room full of divorced women and saying, you completely, like, there's a reason that he exists in that way.
Yeah. He kind of makes a pivot where the crazy almost starts working for him, you know.
Yes.
When he does Tropic Thunder, and he's in the fat suit, and he's ridiculous, and then he starts committing to Mission Impossible, where he's doing these absurd stunts. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, the craziness becomes like almost an endearing thing. Like, oh, look what he's doing.
It's a part.
Look
of
what he's doing for the audience, for us.
But at this point, I'm wondering, when we are at the point though of Mission Impossible 8. Does the whole, like, stunts thing wear thin at a certain point? Like, so maybe the answer is no. I don't know.
Hearing you guys talking about the stunts, and I swear to God, I walked in here and, like, it was, I really don't care who does the stunts. Like,
Cruise cares, though.
I know he does. And so
he wants you to know he cares.
Yeah. Right. I look forward to the Cameron Crowe movie where he is playing the Francis McDormand role. Mm-hmm. You know? That is what I want.
It would be nice to see Cruise stress himself artistically, not merely physically. But next year, actually, supposed to be in a movie from Alejandro González Iñárritu, who did, like, Birdman, Babel, things like that. And we should note that, you know, Cruise has never won an Oscar. He's been nominated 3 times, lost all 3. I think he should have won all 3.
He's clearly the biggest decades-long star without one at this point, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So this could be his chance for an Oscar, and also maybe his chance to, to really show that he's still can do things other than jump out of planes.
Mm-hmm.
Last question for everybody, and I'm going to go first. When you close your eyes and you think of Tom Cruise and you think of a Tom Cruise movie, what is the first that pops into your head?
Ooh.
For me, I will say it is Jerry Maguire. Mm-hmm. It is him on the cell phone. It is him at the Kinko's passionately making the case.
God, help me. Help me, Rod. Help me. Help you. Help
me help you.
It's the cruisiest cruise. It's like it's taking the cruise persona, like the things about cruise, you know, the kind of need to please and the sense of, is he being for real? Mm-hmm. And just makes it a part of the character. And it just works so well. I think that's definitely one of my favorites.
Yeah, his face when he's getting fired is like burned in my memory.
Oh, yeah. For me, I mean, it changes all the time. But right now, I have to say Collateral, actually. This is the Michael Mann movie from 2004, where Jamie Foxx plays this taxi driver who picks up a mysterious fare played by silver-haired Tom Cruise. He wants Jamie Foxx's character to drive him around so he can make some stops before his flight out of LAX that night. And things gonna get crazy on that first stop.
Man, you were gonna drive me around tonight and never be the wiser, but we're into plan B. Now we gotta make the best of it. Improvise, adapt to the environment.
Cruise is kind of using his signature intensity for evil here instead of good. And it's an example of Cruise again, or director, and Cruise kind of in partnership playing with that persona, kind of, he's playing against type here, mm-hmm. but he's just so riveting, and you can tell he's just having real fun with it. And one of the great LA movies.
Mm,
and
yes, that's true.
For those who have not seen Collateral, I mean, it's so good. I can watch it every day of my life and be happy.
All right, Barry, cruisiest cruise to you.
So this is going to sound minor, but for me, it's just such concentrated cruise. And every time I watch it, I enjoy it so much. And it's Tom Cruise in The Firm.
You think I'm talking about breaking the law?
No, I'm just trying to figure out how far you want it bent.
As far as you can without breaking it.
I just love that movie. I really do. I think it's a great movie. And it's about tax lawyers, you guys.
Bring back courtroom drama.
It's
This is such a deep cut answer. Like, you know, my favorite Tom Cruise courtroom drama, Not a Few Good Men, The Firm.
Well, I mean, and remember, the thing that's sort of interesting about it is that it seems like it's just a, you know, naive young lawyer,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah, hotshot dude.
But we do have to see him become seduced, but also become seduced by the money. Mm-hmm. And we also have to see him and his wife sort of reconcile.
Can we just get in our own car and drive back to Boston tonight? We just leave everything.
Find us.
How do you go to work tomorrow? How do you look at Avery? What do you say to him?
I talk about work.
That's insane!
I have thought of every possible way. Here in the Caymans, in Washington, that's all I've done. Try to think of a way out. If we run, they'd find us.
I see hints of Jerry Maguire in that movie.
Yeah.
As much as I see hints of, you know, Minority Report running away from, you know, whatever. And it's, guys, that movie slaps. It is so fun to watch.
Underrated Cruise is when he doesn't realize just how in over his head he is.
Yeah.
I love stressed out Cruise. Mm-hmm. You know, I love when he's trying to hold it together. Cruise is some of my favorite Cruise.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
I'm going to say before we end the segment, Tom Cruise, if you or your people are listening, we had wanted to interview you about your career while flying in an airplane with you. Please be in touch if this is of interest. Until then, that is NPR's Mark Rivers and Barry Hardiman. Always good to talk to both of you.
Thanks, Kat.
Thanks.
That is All Things Considered for this Saturday. I'm Scott Detrow. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you again tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the University of Buffalo. The University of Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. And from Subaru, the new Forester Hybrid offers symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 581 miles per tank, part of the new Forester Hybrid family of SUVs. More at Subaru.com/ForesterHybrid. This is NPR.
finishing time for you and me, dear. The bird